Lord, speak, for your servants are listening. Amen. It seemed to them an idle tale. Well, of course it did. It still seems an idle tale to many people, and even those of us who try to walk the way of Jesus Christ find it hard to believe at this distance what the Gospels tell us, that he rose from the dead, let alone the words of Paul, that we too shall be raised to immortality. Given all we have learnt since the first century about how the human body works, it doesn't make sense. So ever since a few frightened people found a tomb empty and then encountered the one they had seen put so cruelly to death, we explain it all away. An act of deception, a stolen body perhaps, on the part of the disciples. A form of mass hysteria. Anything but what the scriptures proclaim. But this isn't because we are modern people with a scientific understanding of the world and they were primitive and superstitious. That's how it's always been. When Paul preached the gospel of resurrection to the philosophers of Athens, some scoffed and others said, oh, another time, maybe. So when St. Luke tells us in no uncertain terms that the disciples themselves dismissed the story as nonsense, we are on familiar ground. It didn't help that it was women who first started the rumour, because as everybody knew, they were impressionable and prone to delusion. Childish myths invented to comfort weak and gullible people. That's what they say, or that's what they said, to these supposedly incoherent women that first Sunday after he had been crucified. Yet there it is, in each of the Gospels, in Acts and through all the epistles, even in the blood and thunder of the book of Revelation. He died, he was raised from the dead, he is found wherever people gather in his name. He will return to finish what he began. Talk about role reversals. As it turned out, it was the supposedly irrational women who were right and the oh-so-rational men who were wrong. Do you believe that Jesus rose from the dead? Do you believe in life after death? Those are the questions we're used to asking or being asked, and a simple yes or no usually suffices, even if some brave souls confess they really don't know. But if you read the biblical accounts carefully, belief never comes first. Indeed, according to Luke, disbelief was the initial reaction. It was an experience which led people to claim that Jesus Christ was risen from the dead. An experience not of dogmatic certainty, but of something which didn't fit their expectations. The women go to anoint the body by custom and find it isn't there. One of them, in another gospel, asks the gardener if he knows anything about it. And he speaks her name in a familiar tone. A mysterious stranger joins two men on the road, and only when he is gone do they recognize him. That's how the Bible presents the evidence. A series of experiences which led a group of followers of a man who had been publicly executed to conclude that, contrary to all expectations, death does not hold absolute dominion because there is a power abroad which is stronger, more persistent, more abiding than the awful silence of the grave. So we should begin there with the text which records these moments when something happened to change a group of perfectly ordinary people from being engulfed in despair to reaching the conclusions they did. Belief is the child of experience, not the other way round. That is so with all the beliefs codified, say, in the creeds. They aren't there because someone sat down and dreamed them up out of thin air. They developed through argument and conflict over the first Christian centuries, because they condensed into words the experience of those who walked the pilgrim way. The word text derives from the Latin word textus, which is a piece of woven cloth, and gives us our word textile. I find that a helpful image when approaching a written text like the Bible, with so many intricately woven threads forming such complex patterns of meaning. Look, for example, at the verbs Luke uses in the first 12 verses of his 24th chapter. When the women failed to find the body, they were perplexed. It didn't fit their expectations, and into their bewilderment comes fear. When they see two men in dazzling clothes, they are terrified. They are told to recall what Jesus himself had said about his forthcoming death and resurrection, and they remembered his words. Returning to the apostles, they are met with blank incomprehension, for they did not believe them. Nonetheless, Peter goes to look for himself. He got up and ran, and discovering that the body has indeed gone, is astonished. The verbs which describe the experience are disturbing, perplexed, terrified, astonished. Neither the women nor Peter know what to believe when faced with evidence which contradicts what they had expected. Far from finding comfort and hope, they are in the grip of powerful emotions. By contrast, those who have stayed where they were and not shared the experience dismiss it as absurd. They did not believe them. It cannot be. It makes no sense. Death is the end. Maybe there's something afterwards, maybe not, but they simply cannot accept that there has been any kind of interruption to the normal order of things. The exception is Peter, who got up and ran. He, at least, is not content to sit around poking fun at these fanciful stories. He wants to check them out for himself, just to make sure. And when he does, he is left with questions and not answers. Running through the picture of these sharply different reactions to the same event is another thread, something about remembering. Remembering what had been said and not understood at the time. For the Gospels emphasize that when Jesus spoke of his coming death, his followers could not or would not grasp what he meant and try to dissuade him from such defeatist talk. The pattern these words of Luke weave is too honest, too full of raw emotion, of an inability to understand, simply to be discounted as fantasy. As yet, there is but an empty tomb and some kind of strange vision. The risen Lord in Luke only appears on the evening of the same day, when two disciples are wearily returning home to Emmaus, all their dreams and hopes of a better world shattered by the crucifixion of the one they had hoped would bring it about. Then, too, it is memory which unlocks the door of meaning. When the man they took to be a stranger on the road blesses the bread and breaks it, and they recognize and remember the familiar gesture, as we are bidden to remember when we break the bread and share the wine of his presence among us. We would scarcely be human if we did not fear that death marked the extinction of life. But the gospel does not end at that point. After the horror, the blackness, the terrible knowledge that all his words of life, his acts of healing, his welcoming of outcasts, his challenge to entrenched attitudes had come to nothing, there is a garden early in the morning on a third day and a weeping woman who does not recognize a stranger walking there until he speaks her name. There are other encounters which baffle and disturb, each of them shards of light amid the prevailing gloom, hints which grow into the conviction that death has no final dominion over the love which has come from God to dwell among us. And I think you will find that Christians continue to discover the truth of this through lived experience, both on their own individual journeys and in community with others, that Christian hope is born in the darkest places of our fears and grounded in the eternally self-giving love of God. Only when we are prepared to be bewildered, terrified, and astonished by something we cannot begin to understand. Only when we refuse to believe until we see his wounds written large in all the pain of our world can we ever begin to say with the poet, "One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die." Over these last days of Lent and Passiontide, I've been holding in my mind two pictures. One, the first image ever taken of a vast black hole in a distant galaxy, consuming all that approaches it, even light. The other, of course, the flames engulfing the Cathedral of Notre Dame and the spire toppling into the conflagration. Both fill me with bewilderment and terror. The first at the sheer vastness of the universe and how little we know of it. The second at the power of the elements and the frailty of all we build. I do not pretend to understand or to explain them, except to know that our universe is more mysterious and strange than anything I can ever grasp, and to find kinship with those who believe that what has been destroyed will rise again from the ashes. The pattern of dying and rising is written into creation itself and into who we are. Perhaps you can go no further than Peter, who thinks it's a very tall tale, but is just curious enough to keep an open mind. No further than those who are bewildered by the discovery of an empty tomb, as if life had burst free of the prison of death. Or of those who do not recognize the risen Lord as he travels with them, until they sit down to share a simple common meal and remember. But it is enough. You have taken the first steps on the road of resurrection. That road is the work of the love of God, who takes all that is broken and dead and restores it by grace to its true beauty. On that road, and that includes you and me, All of us who sense that we are as yet an incomplete work and hardly know which way to turn to make sense of anything. He may call to you by name in the quiet of your soul. He may come to you at once unknown and familiar as you puzzle over the injustice of the world. He will sit at table with you as you remember his words and deeds. And when day is done, he will guide you to the springs of everlasting love. Amen.